welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pot of thunder and rock and roll. Today, it's definitely rock and roll, or maybe heavy metal, because this episode has been almost 3 years in the making. I've been working on landing this legendary rock and roll pioneer since I first started doing Talk is Jericho. And finally, the day has arrived. The day that never comes has come. He's here. Lars Ulrich of Metallica is joining us today on Talk is Jericho. Definitely the biggest rock star I've had on this show. And I guarantee this conversation was worth the wait. We're talking about Hardwired to Self-Destruct, the band's new record. All of the trials and tribulations behind writing the new songs and recording the new tunes. We're talking about Cliff Burton, the legendary Cliff Burton. One of my biggest heroes in rock and roll. A little bit about his personality. Some great stories about Cliff. Metallica's chemistry. How they've managed to stay together, how Lars and James have managed not to kill each other, their songwriting process, Lars's drumming style, how I feel he's the Ringo Starr of heavy metal, the early days of Metallica, and if you're looking for new bands and new music, Lars is a walking, talking Wikipedia of factual information and trivia on the new wave of British heavy metal, the most obscure metal bands you've ever heard of. We're going to listen to some new wave of British heavy metal songs, and Lars is going to give us a rundown on these bands that I guarantee you've never heard of them. I've never heard of them. You also get some great tips on some of his fave obscure bands, who to check out, and of course, you might even hear him sing a few bars. It's a Metallica interview. Unlike any other, did you expect anything else? Lars on Talk is Jericho, and we're going to jump into the fire right away. But first, we're going to jumpstart your fitness plans for 2017. I know it's one of the most popular New Year's resolutions. Eat better, get in shape, go to the gym. It's something that Lars and Metallica are paying more attention to as well now, which you're going to hear all about. But that's why you need to jump on the DDPY program now. Okay, listen, it's not the New Year's yet. It's getting close. Why wait for your New Year's resolution? Start now, because it's your opportunity to take advantage of a truly great deal that Diamond Dallas Page is offering this holiday season. Dallas loves Christmas, and that's why he's offering this crazy deal. All DDPY merch is 25% off. And get this, and when you buy a max pack or a combo pack at ddpyoga.com/Jericho, you'll get a second one for 50% off of the price that was already 25% off. Okay, does that make sense? And yes, when you buy the DDPY DVDs, you'll also get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. And believe me, that's the way I do my DDP Yoga Now. You know what DDPY has done for me and what it's done for Jake the Snake, Robert, Scott Hall, Mick Foley, Corey Taylor, Rich Ward. They're all doing the DDPY program. I might even try and get Lars involved. And with the app, you can do DDPY anytime, any place, anywhere, right from your phone or tableta. The app not only lets you do all the workouts right from your phone, it's also got a bunch of other cool features to help you on that path to healthy living, all right? You can use the DDP Yoga Now app to track your heart rate and calories. You can use it for pain tracking, measurements, even progress photos. And DDP Yoga Now app subscribers won't ever get bored doing the same workouts over and over again, because DDP has added completely new 2.0 workouts and weekly live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center, all right? And like I said, Dallas's Christmas spirit is in full swing. He's offering you this incredible deal on DDPY. Check it out. 25% all DDPY merch and DVDs, and if you buy a max pack or a combo pack, you'll get a second one for 50% off of the price that was already 25% off, okay? That ends up being like 75% off, okay? Trust me, it's a great, great deal. Courtesy of Santa Claus himself, Diamond Dallas Page. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to take advantage of this great deal. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Change your life today. Get in the best physical and mental shape you've ever been in and do it now. All right, Talk is Jericho fans. I know you love to be the first to know what's up with this podcast, who the guests are on any given show, and when and where the next Talk is Jericho live podcast is going to take place. That's why Podcast One has created a new automated email system to make sure you never miss a single episode, all right? All you got to do is go to www.podcastone.com/Jericho to sign up. That's podcastone.com/Jericho to sign up. And then that's all you got to do. We'll do the rest. We'll let you know exactly when a new show is coming out, what it's all about, who the guests are, the highlights of the show, everything at your fingertips just by checking on your emails. Okay, so sign up now at podcastone.com/Jericho and get all the information on Talk is Jericho to the point, to the minute, to the second. Go check it out and do it now.
Talk is Jericho.
Dude, I know, dude.
We're here.
I can't believe
it. We talked about this for months.
Maybe even a year or two or something like that. I remember I had a radio show
on Nikki Sixx's channel about 3 years ago, and we were talking about it, and you're like, yeah, I'll do it when the new record comes out. And I was like, well, maybe like in 2020, 2022, something like that. So it finally happened. So yeah, man, what's new? Anything exciting going on?
Oh, no, it's been a nice quiet fall. Just been kind of kicking it at home for the last couple of months, doing nothing.
You know what I was laughing at is that, you know, Hardwired comes out, and it's like top three or top five or something, like in 105 different countries. I can't name right. 30 countries.
I know. It's pretty nuts. All that stuff, I used to be really competitive, you know, like 20, 25 years ago. Oh, my God. You know, it's like I used to follow all that stuff and super driven. Now, like when I hear stuff like that, it's more like disbelief.
Right.
You just kind of sit there and go like, that's just so insane. You know, now it's like, wow, it's like... people still care.
Mm.
Can we swear?
Yeah.
So people still give a shit or what, you know, that the whole thing that, I mean, it's like unbelievable that like 35 years into, I mean, anything really, that people still give a shit. And I think that the fact now that, you know, you sort of, as you get a little old, I mean, you have kids and you're not quite where I am, but you're behind me, but close maybe.
Is that,
you know, as you get older, you just start like, slowing down long enough to take it all in, you know what I mean? But it's not just a statement about Metallica, but it's a statement about hard rock or metal in general, that it is awesome for all of us that there still are people out there that care and that give a shit and support the hard rock metal cause when called upon.
You hear all the time, you know, rock is dead, and you've heard that for the last few years. But this year, it's like a lot like, let's say, the summer of 91, when you had Metallica, Guns N' Roses, Van Halen, and Skid Row were all number one on the charts. This summer, we had Guns N' Roses doing a stadium tour. Then the biggest band in America that's not Metallica, Avenged Sevenfold, puts out a new record. They're getting ready to roll, and then you guys come out. So it actually is a pretty damn good year for heavy rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as much as they all want to try to shove us out to the sidelines and make metal this little niche thing that sort of exists out in disrespect land or whatever, you know, it's, I mean, it is obviously awesome that people all over the world, and it really feels, at least to me, like it's getting more and more of a global thing as the world gets smaller, as, you know, all forms of communication reaches every corner of this earth, including, you know, what we're doing now,
right?
That people really are, you know, when I sort of browse through our social media and stuff like that, I mean, we're getting tons of people from all over places that from 10 or 20 years ago that you would never expect. I mean, a lot of love from the Middle East, a lot of love from Asia, a lot of love from all kinds of, you know, places in the Latin world that, you know, maybe Bolivia or Paraguay or not places that are sort of like on
not
the
known
normal
for the scene.
Yeah,
being,
you know,
in those areas.
And so there's just kids everywhere, and at least in our case, I mean, what's a total mind fuck is the whole kind of that somehow the fans still remain. You know, there's as many 12-year-olds and as many 15-year-olds as there was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30
right.
years ago. That's the part that blows my mind. It's not
you guys
it's not just all a bunch of dudes with receding hairlines like myself who sort of, you know, joined.
Not
you know,
all.
Who've been with us for 30 years. I mean, there's a lot, just tons of kids that, you know, we'll do something on Instagram and I'll check it occasionally and be like, please come to so-and-so. I've never seen you play. I'm 14 years old and seeing Metallica is like my dream come true. It's like, that really still happens. It's so cool.
You guys
cool.
have become an evergreen band, much like the Stones, as we mentioned, or if you're talking about, like, you know, kids will wear a Beatles shirt or a Ramones, or there's a lot of, like, T-Rex shirts. I don't think people really know what T-Rex even is.
Yeah.
You find Metallica's in that category now, along with Guns N' Roses and a couple other bands, to where you guys will be just as relevant 10 years from now as you were 20 years earlier.
It's pretty crazy. Who would have thought?
I know, right?
Who would have thought? That's the one question I've been getting a lot this fall.
Like, a bunch of skids coming,
you know,
in.
What would you, what would your 18-year-old say to your 52-year-old self? I'd go, fucking, you know, what happened to all the hair, bro? And I'd be saying, it's everybody's always trying to come up with some strange angle, but, you know, the fact that we're all here and still, and like I said, that the community still gives a shit is really, it just feels like it's hitting at a much it resonates much more than it used to. Because, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, we were always in such a hurry. It's like you never slowed down long enough to take the love in, you know?
Do you appreciate that more now is what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I literally, like we were doing the day Hardwired came out a couple, two, 3 weeks ago. We were in London and we did an in-store. And we haven't done an in-store for a long time. I mean, it's not... We don't do a lot of in-stores. I mean, it's not something that happens a lot. And I was just sitting there, and I guess, I don't know, what, a couple, 200-300 kids came through. And, you know, they always want to, like, in these things, it's always about the numbers. Mm. How many people do you get through? It's like, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to shake every fucking hand. I'm going to look them in the eye. I'm going to say hello, and I'm going to have a fucking moment and just appreciate that some person, somebody, a human being came from all over England, came from Poland, they came from France. They were like basically from all over Europe coming to, you know, central London to stand in line for hours to meet our sorry asses and just have a second. You know, it's not just about writing on a record. It's about having a moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just took it all in. I just sat there and connected with each one of these people and had like 30 seconds or whatever, and it just was really cool. And just, yes, you definitely take it much more. And I mean, 30 years ago, it was, hey, who's got another beer? You know, it was like,
where's the tits?
You know, it's like, you know, I need that shit signed.
You can tell that though. I watched some of the stuff when you guys did that Record Store Day thing at Rasputin's, which was probably, I'm assuming it was up in the Bay Area, close to where you guys came in the scene.
Literally in the backyard.
Backyard. I mean,
10 minutes from where we started.
And then after you went to where the Metallica house used to be, and you were talking about how all the old boys were there, and, you know, mom and Exodus guys or whatever, dads and stuff. But that must have been a cool experience to kind of go back to this time zone, time frame, time machine, to that point in your life when you were just starting now as Metallica 30 years
later. It was fucking surreal. I mean, it was, we were in that house for about 3 years. So when Hetfield and I and Mustaine threw our shit in a truck and drove up north to have Cliff join the band, you know, James and I ended up in that house with a guy named Mark Whitaker, who was sort of the fifth member, kind of the manager, the sound man. Mustaine ended up staying at Cliff Burton's grandma's house in a room at Burton's grandma's house down by where Burton was, where Cliff was down in Castro Valley. But so we were back in that house for the first time in 30 years, and that house is literally like the size of this booth we're in. And the fact that was like our home for 3 or 4 years, I mean, all the songs on Ride the Lightning and Master Puppets were written in that house, in that garage out in the back. Garage is not there, sadly, unfortunately. It got dismantled, and, you know, Hetfield's like, we should have bought that garage and put it inside our studio.
Yeah.
Just build it like a replica of it inside the studio and, like, write songs in there, you know, for old time's sake.
It's like the Cavern Club actually exists in a museum now.
Exactly.
Like the Beatles played. You guys could have done the same thing.
Yeah. But we were in that backyard, and we had everybody from the Johnny Z's, all the people who have been just so helpful all through our career came, and people from Europe and old record company people and tour managers and old, you know, the Gene Ambos of the world and the Harold Lowe's, and, you know, everybody just came and supported. And we were in that party for 3, 4, 5. I didn't want it to end.
Yeah.
I was just like, fuck, this is so cool. And, you know, the house is now sort of, it's still the same house, and, you know, it's, you know, been repainted, and but there's, you know the picture on the picture on the inside of Master Puppets that's taken on that couch.
Oh, wow.
In that, you know, where
with
we're
all
sitting,
all the Chinese food and alcohol
all that,
and
the,
shit.
The, those Halfen pictures, the Chinese food is taken in the kitchen.
Oh, that's cool.
Our friend Skitchy, or my, you know, Rich Birch, his name was Skitchy, who, the sort of the protagonist for the song Master Puppets, he was a guy that he would sleep over on the couch. He lived down the street, and he would come and just basically hang in our house all the time, and he would crash on the couch, and then he would wake up and chop his breakfast on a mirror. That was written about him.
No shit.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you were in that space. It's like, that's where that couch was.
Yeah.
That Skitchy would crash on and chop his breakfast on the mirror every morning, and, you know, to sort of get going. I mean, it was crazy being back in that same space.
I was just in Mexico City last weekend. And I think we were texting each other. You were just flying out of Copenhagen, and I was in Mexico City. And lo and behold, unbeknownst to me, the hotel we were staying in, right next door was the hotel I lived in 93 to 95 when I was living in Mexico. And I literally could have thrown a stone. I hadn't been there in 20 some odd years, 25 years, whatever. Went in there, and like you said, same thing. Same dining room, same restaurant, same front desk. And I just sat there, and all of these memories came flooding
in. Crazy?
Of the people that have passed on. A good friend of mine, Eddie Guerrero, I remember we sat here, we got drunk, he yelled at me, we got in a fight. Did you, when you're at that same thing, when you think a lot about Cliff Burton and some of the experiences
that you had there? I'm just trying to take it all in. Yeah. I mean, the difference between you and I in that situation, when I was in that house, there was 200 other people with me.
Gotcha.
Who were constantly going, hey, how you doing? I haven't seen you in 20 years, which was super cool. It wasn't a sort of like, I didn't get a chance to sort of like stand there and reflect. Mm-hmm. But the people that own the house now, this family that literally like owns houses in the East Bay, they're like, anytime. You know, and I think that they've sort of, the house has become a little bit of a, for the few sort of people that come to explore music history in the Bay Area.
Yeah, yeah.
There's people that stop at 32, 31, 32 calls and go,
that's it.
That's where the boys, you know, wrote Lightning and Puppets and stayed for all those years and all that. So they were super nice. Anytime you want to come back and hang out. So maybe one day I'll go back and reflect a little bit. But, you know, it was a pretty crazy couple of hours. There was a lot of there was a lot of energy. I didn't have a kind of a quiet second to myself. But obviously Cliff is, without sounding cheesy about it, I mean, he's part of our journey and always will be part of our journey. And even if we don't sort of sit and think about him like every day, what would if Cliff was here now, what would he say? You know, any of that? I mean, he's just part of our DNA. He's part of our being. He's part of our story and always will be. And so it's always fun to sort of include him in these things, whether it's super, sort of, even if it's just circumstantial, you know what I mean? He's part of the ride.
He's almost become a mythical entity.
Yeah, but you know? I mean, just circle back to that. I mean, his dad.
Right.
I mean, his dad will outlive all of us, including Keith Richards. Yeah. I mean, he literally, his dad is the sweetest man on this planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, and is so inspirational to have around. And he comes to all these things. And Ray must be, I mean, he's got to be pushing 90. Mm-hmm. And he is clear as whatever, something that's super clear. Yeah.
Clear as saran wrap. Glass.
Yeah, exactly.
A bell.
I mean, he is fucking
ice.
Sharp. I mean, he is right there with it. There's no anything. And he just likes to be included. And just the fact that he's there always brings Cliff also, and not just Cliff, but this whole family, his mom and, you know, had a brother that passed on, and there was some tragedies in that family. And, you know, Ray kind of brings that energy back into our fold, and it's just super cool to always have him
around. Just quickly, tell me a little bit about Cliff. I've always kind of been a little bit obsessed with him because I was a huge fan of his, and when he passed away, I was really devastated because I was a bass player and, of course, one millionth as good as Cliff Burton, but I learned For Whom the Bell Tolls, at least a cheap version of it, and learned how to play, you know, Four Horsemen and that sort of thing, but, like, it's a little insight on the personality of the guy.
He was very, have you ever crossed paths with Jim Martin from Faith No More?
Yeah.
So Jim Martin and Puffy from...
Yeah, Mike Borden.
Yeah, Mike Borden, who obviously went on to Ozzy and Sabbath.
Sabbath.
So the three of them were kind of best friends growing up in down in Castro Valley, Hayward, which is kind of the one part of the East Bay. People used to kind of joke, it's a little more kind of like redneck and stuff. It's, you know, obviously in a very progressive area. Hayward and Castro Valley had a little bit of a rep as kind of more that kind of stuff, right? And so they had, you know, if you've ever been around Jim Martin, they all had the same kind of personalities. They were always kind of very contrary. They were almost in character. They were often fiercely independent, fiercely kind of just their own kind of thing, and like to sort of push buttons and be a little sort of I don't know if shocking is, but like contrary, and just kind of say things that were like a little out of line and so on. And there was a guy, you know, Jim's brother, Lou Martin, who was a dear friend for many years. I don't see him that much now, but, you know, they were all, you know, they had a place a couple hours north of San Francisco where they would all go, like a cabin where Cliff's ashes are scattered now, where they would go, like, you know, shoot guns and go duck hunting and all this other stuff. And we've all done, you know, been part of that whole thing. So Cliff was very... He was into a lot of different musical. I mean, he was into everything from, you know, which has been talked about, like, you know, the Lynyrd Skynyrds, the ZZ Tops, REM, you know, like Simon and Garfunkel. He was into all kinds of classical stuff. He was, you know, he was still in college when we met him. And he was, you know, and not saying good or bad or whatever, he was also probably the one that... I think in those years, he missed home more than any of the rest.
When you're on the road,
he would always, like, for instance, when we were in Denmark recording Lightning and Puppets, he went home when he wasn't doing his bass parts because he liked to be, he was kind of more of a homebody.
Gotcha.
Especially Hetfield and I were much more kind of independent and much more adaptable to sort of, you know, Cliff was a little, I remember the first, you know, few months we were in Europe, like, what do you mean there's no Mexican food? You know, like, you know, you could like understand, you know, what do you mean you can't get breakfast, you know, 24, you know, it was like he was very sort of used to certain sort of Americanisms, you know, whatever, and had a hard time sort of, you wanted breakfast, whatever you wanted, breakfast, you wanted his Mexican food every day, you wanted beer and Mexican food. He was like very kind of, he wasn't sort of, okay, let's just...
Let's
make it up as we go along. He was a little more like, okay, fuck it. I'm done with my bass parts. I'm going back to Castro Valley to get some Mexican food. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he was a little bit more sort of traditional in his sort of worldview or whatever. But I'd say when I think of him, I just think mostly of how totally unique he was. I've never met anybody that was remotely like him. And he was fiercely protective of his own sort of individuality, often to the point of, you could argue, off to the point of sort of like overkill.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Or it just became sort of like, you know, don't fuck with me. It's like, okay, yeah, check this out, check that out. You know, it's like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just Cliff.
But if you look at him too, though, at the time frame, like, okay, now everybody has their own look, but you're talking about 1983, 1984, we all had a metal look. You had heavy metal. You had bangs, tight jeans, high tops. He wore bell bottoms. He had one length hair, lots of flannel.
Yeah, he didn't get
Nobody had that.
No. I mean, he was just, and that was, like I say, a little bit of that kind of redneck thing that, you know, and I don't want to make too much of that part of it. There was a little bit more, you know, obviously, you know, San Francisco at that time was still incredibly progressive and incredibly sort of worldly. And there were pockets around Northern California that were still very sort of traditional and a little more kind of rural, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cliff was very, he came from that pocket and he was fiercely protective of that, you know.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, Lars, we're talking about Cliff Burton, and I want to ask you another question about him. What did he teach you guys as musicians and songwriters?
He was the one. I mean, if you listen to the difference, you know, with an analytical mind about sort of like the difference between Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning, obviously there was this huge, you know, the energy still was there and the heaviness was still there, or more heaviness, but the palette... you know, I guess the palette is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
The palette was expanded, you know. So we never experienced with, like, you know, experimented with like harmonies, you know, melodies, you know. So if you take things like, you say, like Foam the Bell Tolls, like, you know, that melody. If you take, Fade to Black, you know, that riff, the outro, super melodic kind of. I mean, that was all the stuff that he sort of brought to the table. The intro of Fight Fire, that was more or less his.
Wow.
You know, so there was this whole other thing that came from like the whole classical upbringing that he had. He studied classical music, and he was, you know, could sit there and talk to you about Bach and sit and talk to you about Beethoven and, you know, Tchaikovsky, whatever. But you could sit there. I mean, listen, you know, in 1981, James Hetfield and I didn't sit there and, like, you know, didn't sit there and talk a lot about, you know, like classical, classical endeavors. You know what I mean? We're a little more narrow-minded in our outlook. You know what I mean?
Not at all.
So, Cliff just had a really, he loved the energy, he loved the aggression, but there were a few things. I think, you know, I don't think he was a big fan of some of the more. You know, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody.
No.
I don't think he was like a big fan of like Iron Maiden, and I don't think he was a big fan of the sort of the stuff that got
power metal.
That got very sort of pompous. Saying Iron Maiden.
No.
But you know what I mean. Sort of like
you call it Bierstein rock, where it looks like you're like, Bierstein, love heavy metal.
He wasn't a big fan of that. And I remember early on when we started like traveling on the tour bus and stuff, I'd put on some like Maiden or some this, and he was like. He didn't like get up out of his seat and start like banging up and down like the floor. He would, you know, I'd play some Maiden, I'd play some Diamond Head, I'd play some, and then he'd put on, you know, the Rio Grande Mud or De Guello, or he'd put on like some Yes album I'd never heard of or something. You know, I was like, huh? He'd sit there and fly the flag for sort of like Jethro Tull, or he'd put on, you know, like one band he loved was Police.
Oh yeah, wow.
You know, loved, you know, so he'd always play the Police. And so his whole net was just really wide and was sort of completely unencumbered by, you know, how it was supposed to be if you're in a metal band, you know, which obviously James and I hadn't quite graduated to at that time, you know.
There's just one last thing about Cliff. It's interesting because I always hear people that, I'm sure you get all the time, or, you know, the Metallica was only good for the first three records. And if Cliff Burton was still alive, they never would have done the Black Album. They never would have done Load. And I always tell them I disagree with that, because it seems like the melody and the eclecticism of Cliff would want to do something different in that way that you guys didn't change shit around. Do you feel that? Is it hard to predict?
I've kind of taught myself to, it's just like I don't even go there.
Right.
I just, anytime in interviews where the conversation steers towards, what would have happened if Cliff still, well, here's the news, sunshine. Cliff is not here. Right. So it's this is the way history played out. Do you know what I mean? And
sure.
So I don't.
I just think from what you're telling about his attitude and his mindset, he would like to shake up the shit.
Cliff, hands down, was the one that was the most musically, at that time, the most musically varied.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, anybody that sits there and goes, Cliff wouldn't have done that, Cliff wouldn't have done that. I mean, it's just a non-starter of a conversation.
Sure.
Because we don't know. Now, if you take like Enter Sandman, right? So you sit there and it's a great riff and it's a great this, and we're doing this kind of, and we tried a lot of different stuff with Newsted and, you know, this and that. And then it was sort of like, okay, you know what? At the end of the day, just thumping,
just
like
Cliff
straight,
Williams. Yeah.
Doing the Cliff Williams straight eight notes, Roger Glover, Smoke on the Water. It just works for the song. So I don't think Cliff would have said, fuck you, I'm not doing that. His thing was just, what's best for the song? What's the bigger picture?
Bingo, right.
You know, so this kind of fake elitism about, like, you know, this person would have done it.
Right.
How do you don't know that. And I just, to me, what would happen if you hadn't done this? What would happen if this? What would, it's like, okay, well, so here's the history. Up until I walked into the sound booth with you, you know, the only thing we can change is what happens when we walk out of the sound booth, you know, whether we go down the hall or go left or right. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and it's just, I just, the way I am as a person, I'm just not a, you know, what
look back.
I
agree.
It doesn't do anything
because
history is, and it's not even for a, it's not even, you know, some people sit there and go, like, everything happens for a reason. I'm not one of those sort of, it's spiritual and there's some sort of energy. I'm much more practical. This is how it played out. And that's really the end of it. And so you and I can sit here and wish that it hadn't played out that way. But if you really want to go deep, it's probably the way I've sort of insulated myself for the last 30, 35 years, people sit there and throw all kinds of shit at Metallica, you know, hey, what's acoustic guitars on Fade to Black.
You got that flack, right?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, dude, I mean, people have been throwing shit at us for 35 years. And so, you know, the only way to deal with it is to kind of just basically just ignore it.
Yeah.
Thick skin yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a side of me that can weather any one of those arguments, because I've taught myself to have a deflect off.
But especially in this day and age where everybody has an opinion and everyone can go online, the proof is in the pudding of the success and all of the things that are happening with Metallica, and we're talking about Hardwired. And there's something you mentioned a couple seconds ago, what's best for the song. And I have a theory about your drumming, which to me on this record, I said to a lot of my friends, Lars is the star of the show on this record. I'm not just saying that because you're sitting here. We text about it
even
a couple
if you
times.
Were. Lars, I still like to hear that.
If James is here, James is the star of the show.
Either version is fine.
What I really appreciate about your drumming now, and always, but specifically now, is I always say Lars is the Ringo Starr of heavy metal drumming. And what I mean by that is that Ringo always played the exact right parts for the song. Maybe he could have done some more flash. Maybe he could have laid back. But he always played the best part for the song, and it fit perfectly. I find that you, in this day and age, the last 10 years of Metallica, the last two,
awesome.
Three records,
I appreciate that.
You really do have that vibe where you play what's perfect for the song.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been my MO for most of Metallica's career. There was a year or two because, you know, things started so quickly, and we were just literally like half an hour after we started, we were in San Francisco, and then, you know, Johnny Z called, and then we were on the East Coast, and then we were making a record. I mean, it just moved
quickly, right?
So quickly. And, you know, when we came back from Ride the Lightning, it was like, wow. And we had a little bit of time, and at that time, you know, like a month or two was like an eternity. It's like, what am I going to do now for a whole month? You know? And so both Kirk went back to taking guitar lessons from Satriani, and I went back and I thought I could, you know, I'd never really taken lessons. And
I started playing because you wanted to
I just wanted to be in Diamond Head and Motorhead. And I didn't, it was like, well, you have to learn to play the instruments. I mean, it was almost like karaoke in the beginning. It was just like, I just wanted to be in a karaoke heavy metal band, you know, sit and bash along to, that's what Hetfield and I did. We just sat and played along to
Diamond Head. You put the
Diamond
music
Head.
On and play along.
And then all of a sudden it was like, wow, this is getting real. It sort of wasn't really intended that way.
Right.
And so, you know, I'd never really taken lessons. So I took some lessons from one of Satriani's guys, super cool guy. And so Kirk, you know, took lessons and we were sort of, you know, playing a little bit of catch up. And so I went through a period that probably culminated in the Justice album where I felt sort of compelled to try to show ability.
Mm.
It's like, you know, and listen, when you got Dave Lombardo and Charlie Benante, you know, breathing down your back. I mean, it was like, okay, I gotta.
You had some try
to.
I tried to
step it up a little bit and try to do my own thing and do all this crazy shit.
The part on one, that double kick on one, is very intricate.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, and a lot of those things were actually written on the, because we start. You know, I would come up with drum riffs and drum ideas that Hetfield would write.
Riffs too.
You know, riffs too.
Gotcha, right.
Like Justice for All, doom, ba-doom, boom, you know, all that stuff. But I was trying really hard to push the drums kind of into the foreground.
Mm-hmm.
And then after like a year or two of that, I was like, okay, seriously, it's like, you know, just do your thing, chill out, support the riffs, do what's best for the song. So since around, I guess, the late 80s, so I guess it's been like 25 years mm-hmm. now, the only thing that's really interested me is just doing the best thing for the song and sitting and doing, you know, the kind of the Phil Rudd four on the floor when it calls for that. That's really what I love to do. And just to be able to make James's riff swing and to make it kind of bounce and to do all that type of stuff. I just sort of turned a corner where I just stopped being interested in, you're going to try to do, you know, mm-hmm. 32, 30, I don't even know what
paradiddles.
Paradiddles standing upside down, you know, backwards, fucking Lombardo style. It's like, let Lombardo be Lombardo.
Sure.
And I'll kind of just do my own thing. And you know, so, but everybody goes through periods, you know, of that kind of thing. And I got mine out of my system pretty early. And like I said, for the last 25, 30 years or whatever, it's mm-hmm. just been more about making it swing. And that's what I'm happy to do. And then people can kind of say what they want.
And we've heard that before. That one, I think, download or something where you didn't play or couldn't play, whatever the hell happened. They had Lombardo come in. They had Joey Jordison come in. If you listen to those bootlegs, it's like, it's not great. It's not Metallica, you know?
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. I have to say that lying in a hospital room in Hamburg, Germany, while Dave Lombardo was up on stage, that was not one of life's most fun moments.
Do I still have a gig?
It's like, okay. I was on the phone with James. It's like, James, you know, if I leave now, I can, you know, I'll find a plane. I'll be there in a couple hours. It's like, James was like, just get some chill time, stay in bed, do your thing. You need to recover and recuperate and get whatever it is that's going on, like, out of your body, and I'll see you in 2 days. Or, James, man, I'm coming.
Don't leave me. Were you just sick or something? Or you have some kind of flu? Or
it all just caught up to me. I think I had you know, when you kind of...
I've been there before.
When, you know, it...
When you've been burning the candle for both ends for a few months and your body just goes,
yeah, okay, just stop.
Yeah.
In your tracks and lay the fuck down and chill the fuck out. And we'll get back to you in a couple days.
I had that one time. I woke up in the morning with giant, you know, cold sores in your mouth. I had like 20 cold sores in my mouth. And I was like, what? You can't even breathe and you can't eat and you can't swallow. And I went to the doctor and he's like, dude, you need to get off the merry-go-round right now. And I was like, but what's this? He goes, there's no reason for this. It's just your body telling you that you got too much shit going on. So there you go, right? There you go. But you're talking about being on the phone with James. You guys are so close. And I've been watching a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff from Hardwire, but you guys writing songs together and that sort of thing. It's very interesting to me, the process, because you and James basically write the majority of most of the songs, but he's playing the riffs, and you're more like directing and ideas, and it's almost like you're producing, but also chopping things together. What's
that's
that
kind of always been? It's been like that basically since the beginning. It's like he writes these insane riffs, and then I try to find sort of ways to. I guess it's almost like a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you just move one piece here and this piece here, and that will work well with that. And that's kind of it's always been that, you know, arranging it, connecting the dots. Producing, I mean, that's like I, and you know, when we're just doing our thing, we don't wear those hats. He'll, hey, try this kind of drum beat. I'll say, why don't you go to a different note on that last thing or resolve it over here, or why don't you play, instead of playing, you know, 3-1, why don't you play 2-2, or why don't you, instead of gallop in the right hand, try to do a straight down picking order. I mean, there's no boundaries, there's no walls. It's not, you know, he's the guitar player and I'm the drummer. I mean, we're just two people trying to create a piece of music together, whether it was Bob Rock or whether it was Fleming or whether it was Rick Rubin or whether it's now Greg Fiddleman. We have like a language and some like words for things. And it's like, you know, we use the word guy a lot. Like, take that guy and then put that guy or the tail. People say, what's a tail? A tail is, you know, you have a riff and the tail is the back of the riff, you know. It's like, okay, why don't you, you know, take the double the tail, or go, you know, we'll say stuff like A-B-A-B instead of A-A-A-B or whatever, you know, just like,
sure.
And our producers will always sit there and go like, what the hell are they talking about, you know? But we have this kind of instinct thing, and that's kind of just the way that we've always been doing it. The only difference now is that there's 37 cameras running all the time. And, you know, it's sort of like you're just trying to let people, you know, it's kind of fun to share. And obviously now with all this stuff, it's you share and you let people in. It's what we do. And it's kind of, I mean, we've always loved letting, you know, having the door open and kind of let people into. But now we have the ability. So people see kind of how we connect it. But it's really no... if people sat around when we were writing Ride the Lightning or even Kill 'Em All or any of that stuff, it was basically the same thing. Hey, why don't you connect that guy to that guy and put that one over here and double the tail and, you know, try to go.
The one I like that I use with my band is that's stock.
Stock,
that's just stock.
Yeah,
it's just like average.
Yeah,
well,
we used
right?
to, yeah.
It's stock.
I think stock was the, stock is a thing in the, some kind of monster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
when I'm sitting there going, that's really stock, and you just got all mad.
What are you talking about, stock?
But to see that relationship,
because you're talking about bands with the two guys, Lennon and McCartney, Joe Perry and Steve Tyler, Mick and Keith, and there's Lars and James, Paul and Gene. You guys have stayed together, as have Kiss, as have not too many bands, the Stones, but most bands have broken up at some point in time. You guys never did that, no matter Rocky Waters or whatever. That's a pretty cool thing to be able to say.
I got to say that it's a very cool thing to say, and it obviously it's something that as you get older you appreciate. But you know, two things: it doesn't get any easier as you get older. First of all, right. Okay. Second of all, I mean, so or in the wake of that, then is the fact that I would say we put more time and effort and resources into making that side of it work, because if you don't find the right balances, you know, it's fine. You're in your 20s. You're 19 years old. Whatever. You're in your 20s. You're even in your 30s. On the other side of kids, on the other side of all those ups and downs and relationships and watching your kids and, you know, the whole thing and, you know, whether you sort of need to do this and all that type of stuff. If it doesn't function and if you don't sort of sit there and find a way for the ecosystem to sort of live and breathe and how everybody has to be able to sort of come and go and everybody's needs and yeah, I have this need and this guy has this need and he's got to go do this. And there's a kind of a calendar that lives like in this calendar that lives somewhere deep in the bowels of this thing. And I mean, if you could see, it's like, you know, Lars out, you know, school holiday, James out, so-and-so, Jim, it's like, it, you know, the reason that it works now still is because we sort of, we flipped it, and instead of Metallica being the priority, now everything outside of the Metallica is the priority, right? And I mean, obviously, families and kids and life, and then Metallica sort of finds its way into all those empty spaces in there. Mm-hmm, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what's been sort of the I guess, like, post some kind of monster meltdown, that's kind of what we, that's kind of sort of where organically drifted towards in order for it to work. So everybody's got these needs and these kind of things that in order for it to function, we have to be respectful of this and that and so on and so forth. And you sort of learn that sitting there and going, like, why is he doing that? And why, wait a minute, and we've got a gig in Shreveport, Louisiana, or whatever. It's like, you just, it's got to, you can't even go there. The minute, you just, it's empathy. It's like, okay, fine, he needs to do that. Peace.
Done, right.
Something else, it'll keep moving forward, or if you take it into the, that's the practical side. If you take it into the creative side, it's like, you're working on something, it's like, that's really cool. I really like that. And then it's like the other guy goes, it's not really working for me. Like 20 years ago, come on, man. We're going to fucking make it work. Come on. Fuck yeah. It's fucking awesome. Come on. You know, now it's like, okay. But doesn't work for you? Doesn't work for you. We have more material and more riffs and more fucking ideas that we'll ever know what to do with.
Right.
So it's like, okay, fine. Fuck it. There's another idea. It's not worth fighting about. It's not worth arguing. It's not worth belittling the other person. Mm-hmm. It's not worth it. Just, we've learned to sort of stop, you know, we don't even, you
dwell
know, like,
on it or worry about
we
it.
Don't even like, you know, like, it doesn't even get out of the starting gate.
I got you. Yeah.
It just gets
done.
Buried.
Right.
Okay, fine. We'll just move on. And we've sort of conditioned ourselves to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes Metallica function now, is this incredible internal leniency for everybody's needs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a good balance now. We've sort of conquered that in the last sort of post. It settled down and found a way to sort of function on around Saint Anger. And then post Saint Anger, when we came back to it and started Death Magnetic, that's where it really showed itself functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been close to 10 years now, and internally we have like the best vibe we've ever
had in this band.
Now the only unknown is this
shoulders,
and this, the shoulders the
right.
knees, the necks, the backs, the wrists and all that. That's, if nothing happens there. God damn, fucking look at you, man. God damn.
I'm extra pumped right now. I must have a lot of blood flowing through me. Talking to Lars, excited.
But you know what I mean? It's like if all this stuff stays functioning, mm-hmm. we can go on forever.
Because that's something, just uncharted waters. We mentioned the Stones earlier, and they're still rocking at 73 and still doing great. You know, Charlie's still playing drums, but it's a lot different between, you know, Satisfaction and Dyer's Eve or Spit Out the Bone or something like that. We've never seen a thrash metal band in the mid-50s going on to 60, 65, 70. It all depends.
There was nobody in front of us.
Right. It all depends basically on how you feel, I guess, as the machine of the band.
Yeah, I mean, like I've said a couple times in the last few months, when I went to a
desert trip,
you know, it's like the Stones are great, Neil Young's great, you know, everybody's great. Wait a minute, all the drummers are in their 20s yeah. and 30s. Wait, what's wrong with this picture?
Charlie's the only one.
Yeah, Charlie's the only OG. All the rest of them are all spring chickens out there fucking rocking along. And, you know, it's like, wait a minute, how come there's not six drummers in their mid-70s?
Right.
You know? So Charlie is, you know, but obviously in the world of jazz, there's a lot of jazz drummers from the Elvin Joneses to, you know, a lot of dudes where Max Roach, you know, were playing well into their 70s. I mean, mm-hmm. some of those cats even into the 80s. But obviously it was all wrists. I mean, nothing, you know, their whole bodies were mm-hmm. more or less at a standstill and everything was in the wrists, which is what a lot of the Ian Paces and, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, now, you know, as it kind of got into the Phil Rudd thing. And I mean, if you watch Phil Rudd, if you watch like the Paris 79 thing, I mean, he's fucking
his
whole body, the weight that goes into it and the whole kind of, you know what I mean? And so we'll have to see. I mean, you know, I saw Sabbath a couple months ago now, and Geezer, Ozzy, Tony, they've never been better. But it's Tommy back there. I don't know how old Tommy is, but
30, yeah.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the unknown, you know.
Yeah.
So I just don't know what's gonna happen. So we put a lot of the resources and time into workout, if not every day, then close to every day. We got a couple guys, you know, that are sort of with us that mm-hmm. take care of and you know about this stuff, you know, about stretching us you know, a whole, I mean, it's getting very athletic, you know,
sure.
You know, it's like massage tables and strange oils and fucking,
it's no more chopping your breakfast on a mirror and beers.
None of that stuff. Thank you very much. But even just, I was always, you know, a little bit back in the day, it was like, we're hanging out and James and everybody, they're just in their clothes. And it's like, now we got to play. I got to put my little silly shorts on to fucking drum. I always felt a little self-conscious about it. It's like, okay, now I got to put my little Nike running shorts on and they're all got their metal out, you know.
Tight jeans.
Right,
yeah.
You know. And nowadays it's like, you know, like we were up in Toronto like a couple of weeks ago and like, we all just show up at soundcheck. We don't do a lot of sound checks, but occasionally we do a sound check. It's like, we show up at sound check. We said, we're going to work on some of the new songs because we haven't had a chance to practice them. So let's start practicing Halo on Fire and some of this. Sound check, right? And we get down to the venue and everybody just runs up on stage. And within like 12 seconds in the venue, the three of them are up there on stage playing Halo on Fire. I'm down in the dressing room getting massaged, getting stretched, getting fucking worked on. Like I'm
for
about
sound check.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? And it's like, it's kind of pathetic. Do you know what I mean? But it's like, it's what's got to happen. I got to do 15 minutes. I got to get my shoulder and my elbow and my wrist worked on because I don't want to fucking chance it and go up and start playing cold and all of a sudden I pull something.
Right.
But lying down there and it's like, fuck, I hope nobody gets up there and plays those songs.
I hope Dave Lombardo's not around.
Exactly. But so it's kind of, you know, but it's just the way it is. You know,
yeah,
Hetfield
sure.
now has to do his, you know, when he does like gigs and stuff, he goes into like the bathroom and does 10 minutes of la, 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 all that
sure.
stuff or whatever. So everybody's got like versions of that. Kirk does all his yoga and all that type of stuff. But it's just, it's part of the drill now in 2016. And again, I work really well with the whole kind of just, you have to accept the things you can't change and change the things that you sort of can, you know, alter. But no, we're not going to fuck with that stuff. So it is what it is. Like I said, it's like kind of a sports team, but we accept it.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
All right, sitting here with Lars Ulrich, and let me ask you a question, man. Have you ever, just as a fan, tried to play along with Let There Be Rock, like just air drumming or on your set? I mean, have you ever followed along when AC/DC does that live? That's insane.
I'll tell you one story. So I'm at Coachella last year. And so I'm at Coachella, and so Chris...
Yeah, Chris Slade.
Right, so Chris just got the gig, mm-hmm. and it's their first show, and... I hope Chris doesn't mind me saying this. I don't know if I'm like saying anything I shouldn't be saying. It's kind of benign. But he's basically, he just got the gig, didn't fill whatever, you know, that didn't work out. And so there's Chris. And I was like, if they're playing Coachella, and I'm standing backstage talking to him, and they're going up on stage, and he's like, you know, how you doing? How you feeling? It's like, we haven't really rehearsed much. I can relate to that. We don't rehearse very much either. And did you guys play like a couple warm-up shows or anything? No? Wow, Coachella's your first show? I said, when was the last time they hadn't played, AC/DC hadn't played in like 6 years?
Yeah.
Right? First of all, right. Okay? Second of all, Chris hadn't played with them in like 20 years or whatever. It's like, wow, that's really brave. And so they go up. And he's up there fucking jamming away, doing his thing. Oh, my God, Chris, how awesome shape. And talk about a guy who's in his 60s
he's
in great
70,
shape.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah. But they get back off stage, and I walk back into the restaurant. Chris, that was amazing, dude. You fucking... And so he told me, and I hope I'm not saying any state secrets here, but this is kind of funny, and this is all meant as nothing but love. But he told me that he didn't know that Angus was going to go out on that platform. So in Let There Be Rock,
right.
which is fucking quarter notes,
damn,
any drummer, any drummer, I mean, this is like a drummer's biggest nightmare,
yeah.
is basically playing those fucking quarter notes up at this tempo.
For 8 minutes.
But, right. 8 minutes. I mean, that's fucking, that's a hall pass. Fucking Angus went out on that platform during the guitar solo in Let There Be Rock and did the whole thing with confetti and the whole guitar solo out on that platform.
Yeah,
in the middle of the
rises
try
up.
Try like 15 minutes. Right. And I'm just sitting going, fucking Chris is back there playing Let There Be Rock. Playing. And he said, occasionally he went to half notes, like no. Yeah. I said, I think I may have spotted that, Chris, but fucking God bless you. And, you know, hats off for keeping that going. I mean, that any drummer is like.
That's what I always love when people go, AC/DC drums are easy. Oh. It's like, you guys, that's way harder than doing a thrash metal drums, you know?
Okay.
Oh, here it comes.
No, but I mean, listen, playing Highway to Hell and making it swing the way that it swings in those first 16 bars is as hard as any insert super progressive
right.
metal band, you know, 20-minute upside down drummer guy doing something, you know, with four arms or whatever.
Right.
It's as hard. So, you know, enough with all that
sure.
stuff. I mean, Phil Rudd is the unsung hero. You keep looking out there. What's going on out there?
They're giving me the wrap.
They're giving you the evil eye?
Yeah, the evil eye.
We're just getting started.
I know, a few more questions. We got a couple more. There's one question I have to ask, and this is a great story that we share. On the new record, you have Murder One, which is written about our mutual friend Lemmy, one of the best guys ever. Got to tell the story, but when we were at the Whiskey at his birthday party last year, and they're having this great big party for him, and everybody's hanging around, and they have this big tribute to Lemmy on the screen. All these dignitaries and great guys are saying how much Lemmy is their friend and their fan, and they love him so much. He's sitting in basically a throne, and remember what he was doing while this whole thing was going on?
He was reading.
He was reading a book.
Yeah. But that's Lemmy.
That sums it up, right?
Yeah, man, that's Lemmy in a nutshell. I mean, first of all, and I think we have talked about this. I mean, he was unfortunately, obviously, much sicker than anybody really knew at the time. You know, it was like, I don't like to say anything that could be perceived as disrespectful, but there was a lot of love that went into putting that Lemmy tribute together. But I think it was a lot about the people that were putting it together.
Yeah.
I don't think, this is just me personally, and I, again, I say it for the 100th time, I don't mean this disrespectfully to anybody, but I don't think Lemmy really cared that much. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was, but I think it was important for everybody else to do it for him. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that I noticed over those days at the party, the whiskey, and all that stuff, is that there's very few people in our world that bring people together at the level, you know. So, I mean, to me, it was like class reunion. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was like there aren't a lot of people that can gather so many different musicians and players and personalities from the world of hard rock as Lemmy. So I think it was great that we could all be in a room together. But I don't think he really cared that much, you know. And that was just his sort of personality. I don't think that wasn't a diss at the people that that put it together, and he was sick, and I hadn't seen him. I saw him at Glastonbury like 4 or 5 months earlier, and I had a really nice time with him backstage. It was just me and him, 15-20 minutes, laughing, telling stories. But I could tell then he was frail, and so, you know, at the whiskey thing, I had 5 or 10 minutes with him, and he was just not great, but I don't think anybody knew that he was. I mean, this was what, 2 weeks
before? 2 weeks beforehand,
It was kind of crazy, but obviously fiercely independent and fiercely kind of just in his own world, which he had earned every right to be, you know?
I almost feel like once he found out that he was really sick, he almost willed himself to, like, I'm not going to do this. Because he died like the next day. You know what I mean? Like, almost was like, I think I'm just like, let go.
Yeah, I think that's, you know? I think that's what happened. You know? I think people can, I think as you get older, I think you can, you know, if you want to, you can sort of check out.
Mm-hmm. And sure,
I think
sure.
That's
yeah.
what he did, but who knows? But
so I went to his house about a year before that to do, had him on my show, and I couldn't believe they said, go over to his house. And this was not the one behind the rainbow, it was a new place that he had with all the stuff on the wall, every single medal and knife and bullet and gun and flag and all of his World War II memorabilia. And we sat there and talked for a couple hours, and then he asked me if I wanted some vodka. So sure, because he couldn't drink whiskey anymore, but he said, I'm just drinking vodka instead. And it's like, okay, so your liver knows the difference, I guess. And then he asked me if I wanted a cigarette. And I was like, I haven't had a cigarette in 20 years, but Lemmy offers me a cigarette, I'll have one. So we sat there and smoked cigarettes and talked about Fawlty Towers and drank whiskey at 4 in the afternoon. It was like, it's a pretty cool Lemmy experience.
Fuck yeah. That's great. Oh, that's great.
A couple last questions. One of my favorite moments, and something that was completely never been done before, something that Lars loves, something that's never been done before, it's pretty crazy, is when you guys did the 30th anniversary at the Fillmore in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And you guys did 4 nights and 80 songs with 77 different songs.
Yeah, we only played the only song we played more than once was Seek and Destroy. Yeah.
How in the fuck did you guys do that?
That was a pretty nutty week. Yeah, that was a pretty nutty week. It wasn't really intended. It wasn't like, let's do 4 nights and play 4. It morphed into that. But that was a fun week. I mean, fuck the amount of people that came through the door and being able to do stuff with everybody from the Gary Rossingtons to Ozzy and Geezer to the Glenn Danzigs to the Dave Mustaines to, you know, Lou Reed.
Jason was there, and Biff was there, and Bob was there, Bob Rock.
Bob Rock and Kid Rock and, you know, John Bush and the Merciful Fate guys and everybody we're leaving out. You know, I mean, it was an insane Apocalyptica. I mean, it was an insane, insane
undertaking.
And it just sort of morphed into that. I mean, it was one of the best weeks of my life. And to be able to, I mean, if you take, I think like on Wednesday night, I mean, I think on Wednesday night we had, let's say you had Kid Rock doing the Seeker song. You had Marianne Faithful, I mean, rock royalty.
Yeah.
Fucking doing Memory Remains. You had Lou Reed doing a couple of the things we did together.
Mm-hmm.
And then Merciful Fate. Fucking King Diamond, Hank Sherman, Michael Denner, and Timmy Hansen,
yeah.
I mean, talk about covering a lot of ground.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I mean? So to be able to do that kind of shit and just sit there and somehow help anchor that or steer that or whatever was crazy. And doing the sound checks and the rehearsals, people would come out to HQ and do rehearsals and stuff, and it was a great week. Everything was taped, videotaped, recorded, filmed, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So one day, it will probably start. But
no band has ever done that before. That's what I loved about it. It's the first time that's ever been that way.
Well, thank you. That wasn't the intention. It was just a celebration.
But that's you guys. That's what you do. Like, how much rehearsal did you have to do for a song like To Live Is To Die? Never played it. It's almost 30 years freaking old.
Man, dude. We fucking, if you know how much of that shit we fucking wing, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, the fact that we most of the time land in the same fucking place together always just blows my mind. I mean, we're just sort of sitting there looking at each other. I mean, we did have, so we have these sort of monitors or word wedges, as James calls them or whatever, and there's lyrics and there's sort of, I'd have something with, you know, 4X, 8X, you know, 8 times. I mean, some of that shit just gets to be a blur after a while. So the guy that was running all that stuff, all those little cheat
monitors
things
or
whatever, yeah, whatever. I mean, he was...
Teleprompters.
He was there. There was a lot of trust in him for that week. He got a big bonus at the end of the week.
I'm sure.
But man... it's just fun. I mean, it's the same thing when we go on tour. I mean, we on the Death Magnetic tour, I think we hit somewhere between 60 and 70 songs that we could more or less play, not necessarily at a moment's notice, but I think probably around 60 songs I could put in the set list that night, and then we would run them. We have kind of a studio tuning room backstage where we, you know, we're doing stuff like that. So we'd run I Disappear or some...
Freight Ends of Sanity.
You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah, you know, you run it once or twice and just sort of brush up on it. I'd say there's probably, I'd say maybe 40 songs that we could probably play more or less without having to, you know...
Brush up.
But sometimes you just got to remember, like, where does it start? You know, especially I think for James, it's like just if he hears the first note, it's like where's the position on the neck where it starts? You know,
it's like
that kind of stuff. What's the count off? You know, it's like if you get through the first 2 seconds, then often you're okay. It's just like connecting the first, you know.
It's like an actor. As long as you remember your first line,
exactly,
the rest comes through.
Exactly.
What's your favorite songs to play live after all these years?
I think one of the sort of standby or the one to go to favorites that I always just love playing is Sanitarium. There's something about where that sits and kind of how I interact with it every time. I've never played it the same way twice, and I just feel like I can always do a lot of crazy shit in that song. Sapotrue is one of my favorites also. It's one of those songs where I feel really free. There's some of the songs, like, take, like you just said, Freight and Sanity. I mean, that's all up here. It's like literally,
it's math.
It's like, what's the next part? What's the next part? Whew, I made it through without fucking it up, you know. A song like Sad But True or a song like those are completely just physical. It's just you jump in and you never have to really think.
Phil Rudd.
Just you lose yourself in the moment. And those are the super fun songs to play. Those are the ones that sort of come to mind. Harvester is kind of like that, I guess, to a degree. Obviously, Seek and Destroy. I mean, a couple of those.
If you see a song like Whiplash or Trapped Under Ice, how you play that sometimes, is that one of those ones where you got to, like, all right, Lars, here we go?
Trapped is a little more challenging because there's a lot of double bass in that. That's got to, flex. Whiplash is pretty cool, fairly straightforward. Like Motor Breath, that's one we could sort of like anytime hit the lights and hit Four Horsemen.
I notice you play a lot now with your snare. You use a lot of fills using your snare drum rather than the rack toms and all that stuff. That's another thing we talked about earlier about being kind of a Ringo-esque type vibe. You enjoy doing your fills on the snare, it seems. Clive Burr, yeah.
A lot of that comes from Clive Burr. He was so underappreciated.
Great call, man.
Yeah. Rest in peace. I mean, you know all those snare rolls in Hallowed Be Thy Name? You know, the outro. They sounded so heavy. It was like rolls on the snare drum. They just sound punchier. It's like you go up to the toms and it just gets a little thuddier or a little it's just not as aggro. It's like, you know, it's just, it's like air drumming.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a word that we use a lot. It's like, it's an air drum moment. You just, you know, so you take Hallowed Be Thy Name or some of those songs, like Number of the Beast or, I mean, Clive, he's just
he does Prisoners,
so
a lot of snares.
Yeah.
Snare fills,
you know, just
prisoner,
super long snare rolls. It's, that's kind of, and also Duncan Scott, who was the drummer in Diamond Head, he used to do a lot of kind of just super simple snare drums. And then people, again, the counters, hey, it's, you know, upside down paradiddles and blah, blah, blah. But okay, fine. But it doesn't really sound that great.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And
right.
So it's, but a lot of that just comes from Clive Burr.
Are you going to do a lot of the new songs live?
I hope to play every one of the new songs. People have taken to the new record way more than we expected. And I'm actually hearing a lot of people say, so we've been doing these underplays, as we call them, and obviously
small shows.
You know, we're playing one here in a couple of days at the Fonda. And we did one up in Toronto, which was super fun a couple
Opera
weeks
House,
ago.
Yeah.
And we did, the Vance joint in London. And you know, we're playing like three new songs. You're like, play more new songs. Yeah. That's not something you hear often.
Right. That's right.
People are like, play the old shit. Now people are like, play more new songs. It's like, we haven't had any time to rehearse them. So we're sort of, when we start up in January, I mean, we did one thing on Death Magnetic that we've never done before on any Metallica tour ever. On Death Magnetic, we played all 10 songs from the Death Magnetic album on the subsequent tour. We've never done that on any album ever. We've played all the songs from some of the albums, but not on
since then, but on
not
the tour.
On the tour, yeah. Not on the following tour. It looks like shock horror that we may actually rehearse for a couple of days in January before we go to Korea and learn the rest of these bad boys, so we can play them, because there's so much demand, and obviously. 8 years later, we want to get to all those new songs and play them. And I think that a lot of these new songs, some of the Death Magnetic stuff worked very well. Cyanide.
That's a great one, yeah.
Broken, Beaten, Scarred worked well. All Nightmare Long, that's quite an undertaking live. I mean, there's a lot, talk about Frayed Ends of Sanity kind of shit, you know. By the time you got into some of the songs, like the Judas Kiss and so on, it got a little too introverted and a little too cerebral. But I think a lot of these songs on this new album are going to work maybe even better in a live situation, because they're a little more about like the vibe and the groove, and some of the songs are a little simpler, and I think that a lot of them are promising for live stable. So I mean, we're three into it now, Atlas, Hardwired, and
Moth,
and those three are people are digging them. It's, as you know, especially in hard rock, there's a little bit of a strange relationship with new material. That's great. Now get to the fucking old shit. And I'm telling you, I've started hearing a little bit of like, it was great to see you at the Opera House. Why didn't you play more than three new songs? It's like, never heard that before. I mean,
that's great.
That's a good problem to have.
Spit out the bone, man. That's the one.
Yeah, dude. That's gonna be tough. Dude, I played that for my middle son in the car a couple, 2-3 weeks ago, when it came out, and he just looked at me, and there was this long pregnant pause. He goes, "That's really cool, Dad. How are you going to play that live?" We'll figure it out.
Last question. Who's your favorite obscure new wave of British heavy metal band? And do you consider Def Leppard to be a new wave of British heavy metal band?
Well, certainly originally, I mean, Def Leppard were definitely part of that whole thing. And if you go back to the really early shit, like, you know, Overture and everything on the first record, even the old singles, you know, there's a song, there's a B-side of one of the early singles called Ride Into the Sun, one of the great songs. They re-recorded it later, but the OG version. I mean, they were definitely, I mean, they were at the very, very front of it. So absolutely.
You would never hear them say that, though, I don't think.
That's right. Fine. I mean, listen, I have nothing but respect for those guys,
no,
but
I
obviously
agree.
they were the first guy to sort of depart from that, you know, with Mutt Lange on the first album in 81 and then the way they broke America. And so that's fine.
Sure.
It's not a right or wrong contest.
Yeah, yeah.
You said, do I consider Def Leppard to be part of it? For me, they were part of it, but they also dissipated out of it fairly quickly mm-hmm. because by the time High and Dry came out, I didn't love that record. It got a little, the pop sensibility, I just wasn't ready
right.
to sort of embrace that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the obscure bands,
I said that
it depends how obscure you want to get. The problem with the more obscure bands is that when you get down to the third tier, a lot of them didn't do more than a single or two.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not that much material from them. So if you take a band, there's a band called Nighttime Flyer, okay? They had a song called Heavy Metal Rules. I mean, it is one of the great anthems. I mean, it's, you know, it's silly, but heavy, kind of anthemic. I don't think anybody ever heard more from these guys than this one single.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if there's anybody listening that has got anything more on Nighttime Flyer.
Shout out to Nighttime Flyer.
Right.
If you're out there.
You know, there was... because some of the stuff has dated itself,
mm-hmm.
and then there's some of the stuff that still holds up pretty well.
I find Raven was like that for me. I loved Raven in 85, 86. Listen sure. back to it now, it's still cool, but it is a little bit dated. Maybe the production,
right.
song styles, maybe it's something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a band called Trespass, as they would say in England, who had a couple of songs on the second Metal for Mothers album. There's a song called Stormchild and a song called One of These Days. I mean, One of These Days in a pre-Metallica band that I had going with Lloyd Grant,
mm-hmm.
who ended up doing all the solos on the very early versions of Hit the Lights.
What was the band called?
We didn't get far enough to have a band name. But
you played?
We played that Trespass song, One of These Days, which is available, like I said, on Metal for Mothers 2. It's some pretty obscure stuff now. There was a band called Hollow Ground that had a four-cut EP that had a song called Fight with the Devil that got some really, really heavy riffing in it. Kind of that mid-tempo, the stuff that we, not heavy as in Sabbath heavy, but more kind of Diamond Head, the Helpless,
mm-hmm.
kind of the mid-tempo, the stuff that we do on like Ride the Lightning and Master Puppets,
mm-hmm.
those kind of things.
You know them all.
I do know them all. It's hard sometimes just to get put on the spot and kind of, you know, but Jaguar put out a couple of records. You know, there's the first song, Backstreet Woman, you know, I mean, that's some fucking next level shit. There was a song called The Dutch Connection. They were one of the greats, but they were, when you say obscure, I mean, they made an album.
yeah, well, that's pretty obscure
but,
too.
Right, but still,
even
okay,
to
but
us.
there were a couple of bands that just, you know, they had a single. I mean, by the time you started, there's a band called Silverwing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
take Silverwing. They had a song called Rock and Roll of Four Letter Words. Okay, I mean, okay, seriously, should we just fucking find Silverwing? They only had one song that was on a compilation album called New Electric Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
It's around, I don't have my glasses, if I can type. Silverw.
And it's not even silver, it's Silva.
No, it was Silver Wing.
Okay, we're both Googling Silver Wing right now.
Rock. Okay, Silver Wing Rock Band. Let's see what we got here. Rock and Roll of Four Letter Words, dude, okay? I guarantee this is the first time anybody's ever played this on the radio.
Here we go.
Okay. This, I love this song. And Jeff Barton, who was the kind of the main guy at Sounds and Kerrang, he championed this band. Just listen to this riff.
Is that kind of a crash and burn going on right now?
Yeah, it's just kind of like a little bit of an intro thing
right,
happening.
Right.
But wait till you hear this riff. Total basic, but banging heavy metal. Listen. And then the lyrics, rock and roll of four letter words, that's the chorus. Listen.
It's kind of like an early Priest type thing.
Yeah.
Where are they from?
This is somewhere in England. This is the chorus. Listen. Everyone in rock the and line. Roll, the four-letter words. Listen to this guitar solo that comes in before the second verse.
Oh, you just got a text. That's a guy from Silver. Okay.
Listen. That is like Nawabum defined right there, that mid-tempo, like you say, yes. Judas Priest kind of chunking guitars, you know what I mean?
It's reminding me of something else too, and I can't place it. A lot of bands from that era kind of sounded like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about obscure. They had one song. They didn't even have a single. There was no B-side.
Well, about a million people just heard that song, I'm telling you. So that there you go. So the Silver Wing reunion is happening. Dude, this has been great, man. I know you got lots of stuff to do. We'll have to do a part two of just talking
about
metal.
You know what? I could sit here and talk to you all day. Oh, man, this is so awesome, just having a conversation. Let's, you know how we said 6 months ago we were going to do this?
Yeah.
Let's do another handshake. Let's do this again.
We will for sure.
I
absolutely.
Promise.
Lars, awesome. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me.
I'm happy for you too, dude. You guys have been killing it, and I'm proud of you. And
thanks for all the support.
And thanks always. To Silver Wing for Rock and Roll is a four-letter word.
Damn fucking right. Not only is it a four-letter word, rock and roll are four-letter words in plural, boys and girls.
Two of them.
There you go. All right, over and out.
All right, thanks to Lars Ulrich. I got him, man. I'm so excited. What a great interview. Lars texted me afterwards and said they had a great time doing this interview. I hope you had a great time listening to it. It was a huge coup for us to get Lars here on Talk is Jericho. And remember, Metallica's 2017 world tour in support of the new Hardwired to Self-Destruct album continues in January. They're going to South Korea and China. They're headlining Rock on the Range in the United States in May. And the North American tour is coming this summer. It's going to be huge. Trust me when I tell you that. Keep an eye on Metallica.com or follow them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all at Metallica. Thanks to Lars for taking the time for all of us on Talk is Jericho. Had a great time. Got some good tips on obscure metal bands. Silver Wing. I need a Silver Wing t-shirt or a Hollow Ground t-shirt. Jaguar. I look forward to having him back. You heard it here. Lars wants to do it again. I think he had a great time as well. He's always been very cool to me. I'm a big fan of Lars. Love Metallica. One of my favorite bands. I've got the And Justice for All Justice Lady tattooed on my arm. And it's always cool that when you meet your heroes and they're good guys. And I've known Lars for years. And I want to thank him for doing Talk is Jericho. And in tribute, I'm going to give you some more information in the voice of Lars Ulrich. Because as you know from the Jim Brewer show, I do a great Lars imitation. So, all right, Beyond the Darkness premiered on the Jericho Network at Podcast One on Monday. It's a tremendous first episode all about the Black Eyed Kids. Talk about creepy, scary fun. Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis delivered a heck of an episode, and if you're into the paranormal, ghosts, aliens, and UFOs, then this is the best podcast for you. They're releasing new episodes every Monday, so get to iTunes, hit the subscribe button, leave them a 5-star rating and a couple of comments. Get Beyond the Darkness to the top of the iTunes charts. So excited to have them on the Jericho Network. It's something we've never had before. And while you're there, go to hit subscribe on the other Jericho Network shows as well. that's pretty funny. Other shows, the hilarious Team Tiger Awesome Show, pop culture humor at its finest with Nick Money, Truly Engage. New episodes come out every Sunday. My latest favorite was the creative Star Wars character, Crap Dude Fighter. Go check it out. And then, of course, Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus drops on Tuesdays. Get your PhD in wrestling with two of the most brilliant minds in pro wrestling. Great discussion of today's biz. They have a great discussion this week on whether comedy in wrestling is a good thing or a bad thing. And also, Cyrus is really getting on Disco Inferno's case. They got a really serious feud going, Killing the Town versus Keeping It 100 with Conan every Thursday, the flagship show of the Jericho Network. Conan, Kevin Gill, and, of course, Disco Inferno. I don't know how this is going to end with Cyrus and Disco, but check out both shows to hear the feud, the biggest podcast feud in the nation coming down at you. So go subscribe on iTunes. Give everyone on the Jericho Network a 5-star rating and review. And a big thanks to all of you for supporting the Talk is Jericho sponsors. I couldn't do this without them or you. And that includes the OG sponsor, Amazon. You can find my Amazon links at podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button, the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for USA, UK, Canada. Every time you use them links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage of the show to help us cover production costs. You can buy anything you can think of on Amazon, and using them links won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees or extra charges. Just go to podcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, and then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All my other sponsors are there as well. DDPYoga.com/Jericho. Get 25% off all DDPY merch. And then when you buy a max pack or a combo pack, you'll get a second one for 50% off of the price that's already been dropped 25%. That's the biggest deal you're going to get, man. Go check that out. It's a great way to get in shape physically and mentally. Trust me, I can tell you by experience. I can also tell you by experience that Books.com saved my rear end a couple times when they sent flowers to my wife after I forgot about her birthday. That's Books.com. They got your back. And it can help you out as well. Use my promo code Jericho. You'll get $15 off a $60 pouches. Then there's Bowl and Branch. Go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code Jericho to get $50 off your first set of sheets. And you got 30 days to try them. If you don't like them, you send them back. Money back guaranteed, all right? And don't forget, March 15, 2017, I had a big brouhaha with him this week. He stuck me in a shark cage. But that still doesn't mean it's not going to be the biggest podcast ever with Mick Foley when he joins Talk is Jericho for the first time, 80 days and counting. So I'm looking forward to all of you checking that out and listening to that show. And thank you for listening to this show. And keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And coming up Friday, it's something different. I think you're going to love it, though. It's The Power of Music with Seth and Sammy. That's right, Seth Rollins and Sami Zayn talking about rock and roll, what rock and roll means to them. All three of us are massive music fans, talking a full-on, in-depth musical discussion, first concerts, favorite bands, the Beatles, Metallica, meeting our musical heroes, so much more. It's The Power of Music with Seth and Sammy on Talk is Jericho this Friday, the splash show before Christmas. This is present to you, Lars, today, Seth and Sammy on Friday. Who brings you the biggest guests? Who's your boy? Who's your friend? That's me. Yeah, that's me. I'll see you on Friday. In the meantime, and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We'll see you on Friday.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.